The following is a class on the Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, 5th chapter, text number 2, given by His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami on March 2, 1992, in Boston.
One can attain the path of liberation from material bondage only by rendering service to highly advanced spiritual personalities. These personalities are impersonalists and devotees. Whether one wants to merge into the Lord's existence or wants to associate with the personality of Godhead, one should render service to the Mahatmas. For those who are not interested in such activities, who associate with people fond of women and sex, the path to hell is wide open. The Mahatmas are equipoised. They do not see any difference between one living entity and another. They are very peaceful and are fully engaged in devotional service. They are devoid of anger, and they work for the benefit of everyone. They do not behave in any abominable way. Such people are known as Mahatmas. Purport. The human body is like a junction. One may either take the path of liberation or the path leading to a hellish condition. How one can take these paths is described herein. On the path of liberation, one associates with Mahatmas, and on the path of bondage, one associates with those attached to sense gratification and women. There are two types of Mahatmas, the impersonalist and the devotee. Although their ultimate goal is different, the process of emancipation is almost the same. Both want eternal happiness. One seeks happiness in impersonal Brahman, and the other seeks happiness in the association of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As described in the first verse, Brahma Sokyam. Brahma means spiritual or eternal. Both the impersonalist and the devotee seek eternal blissful life. In any case, it is advised that one become perfect. In the words of Chaitanya Charitamrita, Majjhima 2287, Asat Sangha Tyagi Vaishnava Achar Sri Sangi Ekasadu Krishna Bhakta Ara. To remain unattached to the modes of material nature, one should avoid associating with those who are asat, materialistic. There are two kinds of materialists. One is attached to women and sense gratification, and the other is simply a non-devotee. On the positive side is association with Mahatmas, and on the negative side is the avoidance of non-devotees and women hunters. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Gurule Srimani Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Sanyavadi Paschatade Satarane. The main discussion of the verse in purport is about the right association to keep for those who want to make spiritual progress. First, I'd like to address, however, a few possible misunderstandings or questions that come up with some of the words in the verse. And one is this reference that Mahatmas may be impersonalists or personalists. I've always found this to be a puzzling verse for that reason. Those who are familiar with Prabhupada's purports and with the Vaishnava Siddhanta know that the impersonalist who sees the absolute truth as without form or activities, who does not know, does not recognize Krishna as the supreme truth, that person is not regarded as a Mahatma. The most basic definition of the Mahatma is given in the Bhagavad Gita, where the word is used by Krishna in the 9th chapter, starting in verse 13. Mahatmanas tumam partha. He describes Mahatma there. And Mahatma is daivam prakritam. He's within the internal energy. He's not part of the material world. He's in the spiritual energy. Then Prabhupada asks in the purport, how can one get out of material influence and in the spiritual energy? He can do so, as Krishna says in the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, by surrendering to Krishna. So by definition, one would have to be a personalist to be a Mahatma. You have to surrender to Krishna. And then he says, in the purport to the next verse, well, Krishna says, what the Mahatmas do, they're always chanting my glories They're endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me. They worship me always. And Prabhupada writes, the symptoms of a Mahatma are described. He's always glorifying Krishna. In other words, he is not an impersonalist. When the question of glorification is there, one has to glorify the Supreme Lord. One who is attached to the impersonal feature of the Supreme Lord, the Brahmajyoti, is not described as Mahatma in the Bhagavad Gita. He is described in a different way in the next verse, which is others. The next verse begins others, not Mahatmas. They worship the impersonal or the universal form. I dealt with this general topic of how to approach apparently contradictory things in Prabhupada's books in the Prabhupada Appreciation Seminar. And one thing is that this statement is very rare statement that you find in Srimad Bhagavatam. Now the devotees have this ability to call up all of the material from the books by computer. So if you were to call up Mahatma, I'm sure you might want to take an experiment, Madhava. You get it, like 99% it would all be about, a lot of references would be to this Bhagavad Gita discussion. What is a Mahatma? A Mahatma is not rubber stamped, not a politician, not an impersonalist. A Mahatma, a great soul, must be somehow connected to Krishna. And you'd find on the concession that an impersonalist could be a Mahatma, maybe this would be the only one you'd find. There are things like that. So we shouldn't bring these things up just to present a controversy. There's another thing like that. Excuse me. There's a verse, I think in the ninth canto, it says that a good way to get rid of sense gratification is to really indulge in it. Just like if you put, what is it, you put a lump of ghee in the fire? I forget the analogy. Anyway, it's an apparent encouragement that rather than try to renounce material desires, you should indulge in material desires and then you'll get tired of them. Of course, it has to be understood in the context. I think the example is if you put a lot of ghee on a fire, it'll put the fire out. But obviously the general instruction is that some control should be there on sense gratification, not indulgence. So these very rarely mentioned points, just by their rarity, have to be balanced by the Siddhanta. Aside from that, still we have to honor them on their own. So we do know also there's a distinction between a person who has understood this far in spiritual life, that there is Brahman, there is eternal spirit, other than this material world. That person is sometimes called a Brahmanandi. Here, the word Mayavadi is not used as a Mahatma. It just says one who has impersonal realization of Brahman. So that's significant, that he's not advocating impersonalism and blaspheming the personal conception. But the Brahmanandi has only arrived at this point, and if he is perfectly behaved in regard to renunciation and association with sadhus, he's called a Mahatma in this particular verse. So I won't go further with it. It's certainly a liberal description, which we can sometimes do. We can speak in sometimes different contexts. Srila Prabhupada would sometimes praise attendance at the Kumbh Melas. He said, oh, the Kumbh Mela is a congregation of saintly persons. Some may be impersonalists, some may be personalists, all kinds of different places, but they're all sadhus and they've all come for liberation. But at other times, when he arrived at the Kumbh Mela and spoke to the devotees, he said he didn't speak highly at all of the impersonalists. But one can speak also on different levels, so to speak, and they're not contradictory or hypocritical. There are different levels of reality. So in one sense, certainly renounced impersonalists are great souls compared to the materialists, the karmis. But compared to the devotees, they're not great souls. And therefore the word Mahatma cannot be used for them. Another thing to explain here is the references to non-devotee activity as being fond of women. So it doesn't mean that women are evil or are maya, and therefore they're grouped on this side of what's to be avoided. Rather, it is people. The word women actually, it can be interchanged for men. Women or men, if men regard women as objects for exploitation or sense gratification, that is wrong, as implied also by the word avoid women hunters. Women hunters means women exploiters. In Vedic culture, women is honored and protected. So you can read that to say, people fond of exploiting women for sex, or women who are attached to men, taking it the other way, or if you take it homosexual way, any kind of approaching for sense gratification is the path to hell. So it's not to be taken as a statement against women, but against sexual exploitation, which is generally done by men to women. So from the viewpoint of a man who wants to engage in spiritual life, if he is attached to being with women for sense gratification, or with men who are themselves placings of women, then he will not be able to make spiritual life. Or from the viewpoint of a woman, if she just associates with women who are just always crazy about men and not spiritual life, materialistic women, or if she associates with men just for sex, then her path to spiritual life will be thwarted. All right, so the meaning is summed up of the verse, and the purport is summed up in the verse that Prabhupada quotes, asat sanga tyag evaishnava char stri sanga eka asada krishna bhakta ar. We can almost picture a painting, some of the visual words used here, that human life is a junction. So here's the human being, an allegorical human being, every man. He's on a road, and there's forks on the road. A fork. And one way, at the end of one road, there's a door, which is liberation from material life. And the end of the other road, there's a door which leads to suffering material life again and again. So he's being advised, the father is advising his sons, Rishabha is advising his sons to make the right choice, and it's either or choice on the junction. And there are many things that are included in spiritual life, but the main thing that is pointed out here is you should serve saintly persons, mahat sevam, and doing that alone will bring you to the success in spiritual life. And where there's a recommendation, there's a prohibition. So don't associate with people who are not saintly. So, and then saintly, well, then we say, well, what is a mahatma? What is a saintly person? And there are some descriptions here. So finding out those persons with these good qualities. So some we look up to as being superior to us, like gurus to us. And some are our friends or equals. And we have different relationships. And some are just coming to spiritual life. We have a relationship with them. They're also sadhus. And we should serve all of them. We don't only serve the gurus, we serve the friends, and we serve the juniors. And This is to be done as your exclusive society. Now this is clear, but it's a very strong statement, and devotees can make this among themselves, but when we say this, and of course the teachings of Krishna consciousness are open, the classes are open for non-devotees as well as devotees. And Prabhupada says that actually the topics of Krishna consciousness, they're meant to be discussed by the spiritual master and the disciples. And Krishna says that also. Those who are not austere, they shouldn't hear this message. But even if we say that devotees should only stay with devotees, but still we want to increase the society of devotees, so that the society of devotees will be more vibrant, and so that those who are non-devotees will be saved from going on the hellish path. How do you increase the society of devotees if you are going to shun completely the non-devotee? And if the discussions are closed to the non-devotee, there will be no way they can ever find out about it. Well, that's the real negative definition when we say insular, that society is too insular or cultish, where everything is secret and no outsider is allowed to understand what they're doing, what's going on. Everything is shrouded in secrecy. So the devotees, therefore, they hold open class, and non-devotees may attend, and that's mercy upon them. But also, there's the risk of misunderstanding strong injunctions which are good for spiritual life, which a devotee will understand, but which may seem too exclusive and insular or strict and so on for the non-devotee. The non-devotee who doesn't want to take the spiritual path, he should at least understand, well, this is for those who are very serious. I cannot take this. I do not want to take this. But I can understand that if I were serious, this is certainly the advantageous way to do it. And he should not have an envious or malicious attitude towards the devotees in their spiritual pursuit. And Prabhupada also used to refer to the independence of the living entity to go to hell if he wants. So the devotee can grant that to the non-devotee. We're not trying to force you to be a devotee. But the truth has to be spoken, whether somebody likes it or not. Otherwise, if we're simply concerned with like public relations and saying something that doesn't offend anyone, then we cannot speak the truth. So the devotee should associate only with persons who are pure and are practicing spiritual life. There are some references that our researchers gave me of this. I wanted to hear some references to the Asat Sangha verse, and they gave me a few, and I underlined some interesting parts. One reference was about a particular item of food, how the devotee should take food, which is devotional food and which is prepared by devotees. If an A-Vaishnava, non-Vaishnava, offers food in the name of Mahaprasadam, it should not be accepted. So this is a great act for our purification, when we learn that you should not eat food before you offer to God. And if you eat food without offering it, it's lumps of sin. Because Krishna provides the food, so a devotional offering should be made. So it's a great step forward to stop all that accumulation of karma by eating forbidden foods, eating meat, and eating unoffered foods. And it's not to be done like sometimes. Once you understand the principle, you don't want to eat anything. How much poison does it take to disrupt your system? So you always want to eat food that can be offered to Krishna. But then, as in, we're going to see time and time again, in trying to follow this principle of satsanga, but living in the material world, there's so many awkward situations. So one awkward situation is that offered food is not always available. or we're mixing with non-devotees, and sometimes it's awkward to demand for an arrangement of prasadam. But Prabhupada says that in any case the food should not be accepted. So one has to just speak out in such situations and say, I'm a vegetarian, or I'm a devotee. I only can eat food that's offered to Krishna. So sometimes someone might say, all right, I'll offer the food to Krishna for you, or what has to be done? So say, well, no, you can't offer the food to Krishna. Ordinary food cooked by an A Vaishnava should not be accepted by a Vaishnava. Even if an A Vaishnava cooks without fault, he cannot offer it to Lord Vishnu, and it cannot be accepted as Mahaprasad. So one way to respond to this suggested here is that the devotee can himself cook food and offer to the deity in a situation like that, if possible. And then specifically, he says that a devotee should be very strict in not accepting food from a non-devotee, especially food prepared in restaurants or hotels or on airplanes. So, enough said. That's an injunction about food. Then, in general, the association with non-devotees is like the maddened elephant is set loose. The living entity is a social animal, and if one gives up the society of pure devotees, he must associate with non-devotees. By contacting non-devotees and engaging in non-devotional activities, a so-called mature devotee will fall victim to the mad elephant offense. Whatever growth has taken place is quickly uprooted by such an offense. So the association of devotees is such a precious thing. We agree on so many precious principles of life, and we share them. Sometimes we take it too much for granted. But once you're plunged into the society of non-devotees, you see none of these things are taken for granted, and most of them are not accepted even. That one should not eat meat, or one should not waste time in non-spiritual activities. So Prabhupada has very kindly brought the teachings of Lord Chaitanya to the West and created a Krishna consciousness movement in which we can live and socialize, fulfill all the human needs, and still avoid the non-devotee association. Where Krishna is not respected and worshipped, where the pure devotee is not respected, and where all abominable things are taken as normal. This is a very degraded age, and we have to protect ourselves from this contamination. Now, an interesting point is brought up about a theoretical person who is a devotee, wants to associate with devotees, but thinks that the available devotees are themselves not fit for different reasons, or he cannot get along with them. So the one society of devotees that's provided in this world, he finds that he cannot live, or she cannot live in that association. So this often happens, unfortunately. You hear people can't get along, it's just like in each city, like in Boston, practically every block there's a Catholic church. So maybe you don't get along with the priest or the parishioner in that church, you go to another church. But in ISKCON, you're lucky if you have one chance to associate with devotees. So if for some reason, maybe quarreling or something, you don't get along with the devotees, you can be in a difficult situation. And sometimes people get so, devotee may get so cynical that he says, actually there are no devotees in the Krishna conscious movement. They're all pseudo-devotees. So Prabhupada covers this point. He says, if one thinks that there are many pseudo-devotees or non-devotees in the Krishna conscious society, one can keep direct company with the spiritual master. And if there's any doubt, one should consult the spiritual master. However, unless one follows the spiritual master's instructions and the regulative principles governing chanting and hearing the holy name of the Lord, one cannot become a pure devotee. By associating with non-devotees, one breaks the regulative principles and is thereby lost. So this is a very severe condition, to say that the devotees are pseudo-devotees. Prabhupada concedes that there's such a person, and he recommends some treatment. But this should be understood as a mercy on such a person, and the person is in a very strange situation. First of all, why should we say that there are no devotees, that they're all pseudo-devotees? Is that a fact? If you think like that, then he's saying, all right, then this is what you should do. He's not rejecting you. But still, it's an unrealistic proposal to say that they're all pseudo-devotees and I'm the only devotee. What pride to think like that. There, we can say, agree that all the that many of the devotees have faults, that they're not perfect, but are they non-devotees? Are they pseudo-devotees? So anyway, he says that if you're so feeling like that, so alienated, then at least associate with the spiritual master. Now, how may we take this? You can't say, "I'll go to the spiritual master and say, all right, then I want to live with you." That's often not possible. But that may be possible. That's one meaning of this statement. They said, all right, then you come to me. Actually, this is based on Prabhupada's personal experience that he's writing this. So he would sometimes tell them, then you come to me. It's like a challenge to that person who says, well, there are no devotees, and I can't associate with any devotees that I know, therefore I'm associating with the non-devotees. It's not my fault. And Prabhupada said, would challenge them, then you live with me. So then are they going to reject him and say, well, you're also a pseudo-devotee? No, they won't say that. But then they won't be able to live with him, or they won't want to live with him. But that's actually happened, that he has told them, you come and live with me, and they wouldn't. He's made himself available like that, and they wouldn't. And that exposes that it was not a real thing, that they actually didn't want to be a devotee. Maya was making up this excuse to say there are no devotees. But even if that's the situation, then you could perform guru seva. If you were somehow thrown out of the society of devotees, you could still follow the spiritual master, and that would be your association. But you'd have to follow the rules and regulations. And practically, it's like becoming a hermit or something. That you'd say, well, there's nobody, but I'll follow my spiritual master, but I won't associate with the non-devotees. So we're talking about treatment for a rare case. This is what that person could do. But it's not recommended behavior. Now, another thing is that we don't... Now, the Mahatma is described as being very... kind to others. He must distribute Krishna consciousness to persons who are hostile without becoming angry at them. Obviously, he's not shunning non-devotees. He's mixing with them, but not mixing with them in an intimate way to follow their habits and ways of life. To watch television and drink liquor and do all the things that they do. But he will stay with them if they want to hear about Krishna. In some way, he can serve them also. The devotee is a servant to all. Therefore, this verse about avoiding the non-devotee doesn't mean that you stay alone and never mix with the non-devotee in any form, but you ought to mix with them. Prabhupada writes in one purport, for less advanced persons, they may stay alone in a secluded place and chant Hare Krishna. But those who are more advanced can mix with the non-devotees without becoming affected by their bad behavior. So this is actually recommended, because if we're going to serve the Mahatma, and if the Mahatma, if he's engaging in welfare work for everyone, then how are we going to serve him except we will do that also? And then we're going to be in contact with the non-devotee. But it will not be against the principle of a sat sanga tyag if we do it always as devotees. And that means we should try to come regularly back into the association of devotees after these forays into the ranks of the non-devotees and the materialistic world to try to distribute Krishna's message in one way or another. There are more things we can discuss. Just briefly, I won't take up so much time, but another thing to be discussed is what is the quality of the association among the devotees? We have this group we're calling devotees and some other much, much larger group in the material world, the non-devotees. And we say we want to associate with the devotees. So what is the quality of that association? It's not just that they live together in the same building or dress the same way or move through the same rituals and so on and so on, share the same economical life. Association is, it may include those things or it may not. But it has to involve sharing talks about Krishna, working together in Krishna consciousness. So in other words, it should not be superficial or official only, but it should be based on Krishna consciousness to help each other in spiritual life. And then we get the real nectar of Vaishnava Sangha, which is, it can be very, very sweet and fulfilling, and you'll have no hankering for material life or material association. If you can get real Vaishnava Sangha. If somebody is getting actual Vaishnava Sangha, he doesn't also want non-devotee association, which is available, by the way, obviously, not just by meeting face-to-face with people, but by television, by reading. What's the non-devotee outlook on this? What are they doing? I want to hear, I want to see. This means you're not satisfied with the Vaishnava Sangha, or you don't actually have Vaishnava Sangha. But if we have it, then we're not interested at all in anything except more Krishna consciousness. Therefore, each one of us is responsible to try to not commit a kind of violence to our God brothers and God sisters by giving a prajalpa association, or bad association, but by actually being a devotee and trying to help each other in Krishna consciousness. Alright, I'll read the verse again and I'll see if there are any questions. One can attain the path of liberation from material bondage only by rendering service to highly advanced spiritual personalities. These personalities are impersonalists and devotees. Whether one wants to merge into the Lord's existence or wants to associate with the personality of Godhead, one should render service to the Mahatmas. For those who are not interested in such activities, who associate with people fond of women and sex, the path to hell is wide open. The Mahatmas are equipoised. They do not see any difference between one living entity and another. They are very peaceful and are fully engaged in devotional service. They are devoid of anger, and they work for the benefit of everyone. They do not behave in any abominable way. Such people are known as Mahatmas. Jai, Hare Krishna. So, any questions or comments? Yes, Vishalaka?
I have two questions. Your Holiness, Sri Maharaj Goswami. One question is that once I asked Srila Prabhupada in India, I asked him, I said, Srila Prabhupada, I understand there's not so much love and trust in our society. Why is that? Because we emphasize love and trust.
Yeah.
And Prabhupada's answer was because of material desires and envy. So you were mentioning about how we should relate with each other. Oftentimes devotees come and they do all, there's so much politics. This is a politician. I can't relate with them. They don't like me. They don't love me. What's the attitude of the devotee who feels that their personality naturally can't get along with everybody?
Yeah.
You know, how does one cope with all these different personalities? And how do we relate with people who we feel don't love us or care for us? Or
Well, in the Nectar of Instruction, Rupa Goswami says that we should honor anyone who chants the holy name, even if they're not on the bed, following rules and regulations. So some like mental honor should be there. We shouldn't have, if they have that one great qualification that they do chant Hare Krishna and they're trying to practice Krishna consciousness, then we should try to honor them. But if there's so many things that we don't like about them and they don't seem to appreciate us, then we're not required to try to develop an intimate relationship with every devotee. We can discriminate in our intimate friendships, but should honor them all. Well, that's a good guideline. Find someone who's like-minded with you, and in that way. Because if you associate too intimately with those who you can't seem to get along with, then it may start committing offenses. You commit offenses to them. That's even recommended in Lord Kapila's teachings. Very realistic discussion is there that devotees are sometimes mixed in the different modes of nature. Devotional service mixed with ignorance, with passion and goodness. So if you find a Vaishnava who you find is has some of those materialistic qualities, Prabhupada says, it's not that you have to associate with them. But still you have to give them the credit.
Thank you very much. The other question is about, you mentioned that we shouldn't take food cooked by non-devotees, and you mentioned three places like a restaurant, a hotel, and an airplane.
Yeah.
I want to get this clear, because sometimes you might be traveling from time to time on a plane, 3,000 miles or 5,000 miles away, and a devotee may order a vegetarian, pure vegetarian food, and then offer it. Now, is that completely wrong to do? Sometimes we hear Prabhupada accepted certain things.
Yeah. I just read that. That was his purport about the airplanes. He didn't get into an intricate discussion of the possibility of getting a pure vegetarian meal on an airplane. But that's a discussion in itself. Like sometimes to say, oh, you're getting a vegetarian meal? Or say, for instance, no, I don't want anything. No, we have a vegetarian meal. And there's a vegetarian meal in the bread or in the whatever, the biscuits, there's eggs. In the such and such, there's, you know, something else. There's animal products in the yogurt. So their idea of, and then grain, everything is grains that are cooked by them. So you can't even offer most of it, what is called vegetarian. They have a fruit plate on some of the planes, that's good. Okay. I try to get that, I consider that offerable. Nice fruits. But definitely on the plane you're going to be restricted. Also, you want to talk about plane travel, you say like 5,000 and more flights, it's good not to eat so much in the flight. You won't get jet lag either. So, if you have devotee friends, maybe they can make you something. You can carry some prasadam. But if that's the situation, make sure it's vegetarian. And the only thing I can think of would be fruit. Or maybe a fresh salad or something. But otherwise, it's hardly even vegetarian or offerable.
You're sacred to have someone make it for you.
Oh, yeah.
That's the safest and best way.
Oh, yeah. Best tasting also. Often when devotees are eating the students will say, well, what's that? That looks good. It's better than what we're giving. So I always saw Prabhupada on the plains having nice tiffins full of food that had been given to him by devotees.
Well, what does sometimes someone say, Prabhupada had a 7-Up, you know, and I'm drinking a 7-Up, you know? I don't know, I've never seen Prabhupada take it, but what is it? Did sometimes did Prabhupada take things?
Yeah, he could do anything. Anybody else?
Like you were saying that the statement that the material desires, when they are appeasable, if you rather like indulge them than try to like violently remove them, something like that.
Yeah.
My question is, what would be different between, okay, I know you have experience in like a, you know, in Zen or some even. Uh-huh. Like what is in Zen or in Eastern philosophy is the same, that we rather not try to violently like make effort to remove desires, but rather to just watch them without any interaction. They will eventually themselves like separate from the interaction of them. So what would be the difference between those two statements?
Well, there's a similarity. But I brought that up. I was making the point that sometimes we find a very exceptional teaching that seems to be quite different than everything else Prabhupada is teaching. And I mentioned this one verse, which is very unusual. I thought some of you would know it and even help me with the analogy. But there's two... Yes, ma'am?
I know. We just recently read it. And it said that... and it's mentioning the mixed castes. And it's saying that among the lower castes, sometimes the people get so tired of their unlimited wine limit that just like pouring small drops of ghee in the fire will increase it, but if you pour a whole lump of ghee, then it goes up. So sometimes they'll come to the realization after a lot of lusty activities to keep them all up.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Thank you. So, now, it's almost like you latched on to that right away. As a, this is my philosophy. This is the Bhagavatam philosophy. Enjoy women and sex and intoxication, because then you'll burn out and get tired of it. But it's... First of all, it's like the only instruction you'll find like that practically in all the Bhakti Vedanta purport. And it's had the first Shudras who are going to do that anyway. And so it's the attitude toward them as well. Let them do it and they'll get tired of it. But it's the serious candidate for spiritual life agrees to restrain himself even though he has an inclination for those things. Because mostly the instruction is you won't get tired of it. You'll do it and do it and do it and you won't get tired of it. You'll just keep trying and trying and trying. So the other is like a contradictory to that statement. But the more central instruction is that a conditioned soul will not get tired of his sense gratification and give them up, but he'll just stay bewildered and keep trying to be happy. We don't see people taking the spiritual life by indulging in the sinful life. But you have to take to the spiritual path. As far as the other point about meditation, that can be applied in the subtle realm, that we can't always stop our mind from thinking of sinful things. By force, we can't stop it. So you can just notice that I'm thinking these nonsense things still. But that doesn't mean that we only do that. We also... by our behavior, at least, stop sinful activities. And our meditation is not like that. We're like, in Zen meditation, one sits down and whatever comes, you just let it come and just continue to sit. But we chant Hare Krishna, and that by that positive way, we drive out the dirty and dusty things in the mind, and Krishna comes into our mind. It's a forceful kind of meditation on the holy name.